Well, good morning, and welcome to this Smart Stimulus event at CSIS, and we're going to be looking at the ramifications for the United States and for the global economy of the new stimulus package and the debate on long-term spending in the United States. And I'm Stephen Schrage. I'm the new Scholl Chair in International Business here at CSIS. And before I turn over to what is really an all-star panel of CSIS experts addressing all different aspects of this issue, I wanted to address three quick cross-cutting points that we may be looking at as we look at the stimulus package and the broader term financial and spending issues facing the United States. First of all, this is really an unprecedented package. The size, $819 to $827 billion, is unprecedented. It's a bit of an apples to oranges comparison, but in terms of the raw numbers, it's 1.5 times or greater than the defense budget, which gives you a sense of the type of scope of spending and tax cuts we're talking about. But just as important, it's unprecedented in terms of speed. In terms of years or months of debate on some of these things, we're moving very quickly in terms of weeks or days, and I think that's going to have ramifications both in terms of the package and in terms of how it's implemented in the months and years ahead. The second key point is this raises some economic questions, focusing on two real areas. One is return on investment, or ROI, and opportunity cost. In terms of return on investment, we're putting massive spending out there, putting a huge new debt on the American people. So the question is, what are we going to get in return for this massive amount of spending? The president aims to add or preserve 4 million new jobs, and it's clear the bill is focused both on two key aspects, which some economists have debated whether it can effectively address either if it's trying to address both simultaneously. The first is stimulus, getting money into the economy rapidly and quickly to offset the effects of the downturn. That's a fairly straightforward debate. People talk about spending versus tax cuts. It's fairly measurable. And with 64% of the estimated bill going into the economy in the first 2 years, there's still a significant chunk that obviously isn't stimulus in the traditional sense, which brings us to the second goal, which is investment, or reinvestment as it's termed in the bill. That's a much trickier question politically and economically in terms of what works. One senator's important critical investment priority is another congressperson's pork barrel project. So you see a lot more debate in terms of what it actually is going to start up the economy and have long-term effects. For example, many agree areas like education or technology, broadband, or infrastructure are needed, but the Bridge to Nowhere was an infrastructure project. Japan spent massively on infrastructure projects during the lost decade, so targeting and how effectively the spending goes forward is going to be a key question. And I think we've got an incredible range of experts here today to address how the spending is prioritized and whether this meets U.S. needs. Both of these are complicated by speed. It's really hard to spend money wisely and quickly. And as many people have pointed out looking at this package, there's unprecedented opportunities for waste, fraud, and abuse just because of the size of the package. I think to the President and the Congress's credit, they put in a lot of transparency provisions, provisions for additional IG funding and others, but a lot of this is only going to take impact after the money's been spent or allocated, which raises questions about whether it's going to highlight wasteful spending or other issues that may be seized on politically. I think this brings us to the issue of opportunity cost. There's a huge amount of both dollars and political capital that were invested in this bill moving forward. One key question is going to economically or from a budget perspective crowd out other critical needed investments. Some people have talked about recapitalizing the military after Iraq and Afghanistan, or people have said this may require cuts to military spending. So that's one key issue, along with a lot of others, I think, that needs to be addressed. And also, will instances of waste be seized on politically as a football, whether it's right or wrong, to prevent the capability to address massive new needs in the future? Also, there's going to be a long-term exit strategy that's going to be needed with this plan, and we can talk about that in terms of demographics and entitlements over time, whether taxes will have to be increased or how we're eventually going to dig ourselves out of this debt that we're putting on ourselves in the short term, but which many people, and I think most economists, agree is needed to get us through this rough patch over the next several years. And that brings me to the final point, which is that as the crisis showed, this is really a global crisis. And we're in an interconnected world, and the world is really watching what we do here today. I think that's true both in terms of the Buy America provisions that have been really discussed in the bill and that could potentially spark a trade war, and the history of the Great Depression gives us some cause for pause on that. And I think the president deserves credit for speaking out against that. But even the Senate fix provides opportunity for trade frictions in the sense that it excludes China, India, and Brazil and others that aren't part of certain agreements. And if we push the boundaries of what's legal under the trade system, it's really going to strain it in terms of will it be able to react quickly enough to prevent some type of race to the bottom. But just as importantly in the long run is the question of the world is watching to see whether the U.S. can get its act together to act decisively and quickly on these issues, both politically in terms of coming together, but also in terms of economically over the next year to see whether this is really going to start back up the U.S. economy or whether we have the political will to address these questions. So with that, I'm going to turn over to our panel. And again, we really have a very impressive team from across CSIS. We've got David Berteau, who can address defense issues. Robert Ebel, a senior advisor on energy, who can address critical parts related to energy in the stimulus plan. Charles Freeman, our Freeman Chair in China Studies, but also has a perspective across Asia in terms of how this is viewed. Richard Jackson, who can address the very important demographic issues and how we address these long-term with the entitlement problems we face. Jim Lewis on technology, who can address the broadband issues and the greater high-tech roles that are influenced by the spending discussion. Steve Morrison, who's one of our top expert on health issues globally and can also address some of the provisions in the bill and how it relates to our long-term strategy there. And finally, Sidney Weintraub, who's got a wide range of experience on economics, looking both domestically and internationally at how these questions and debate will devolve. And we're very proud to have them here and look forward to all of their thoughts. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Stephen. I'll start out by noting that much of what you commented on is certainly relevant from a national security perspective, and we'll see how it plays out. When we agreed to host this event and try to put something together, of course, we had no idea what exactly the status of the stimulus would be on the morning that we sat down here. So it's with great delight that we discover the possibility that legislation is still alive and that we're not here to deliver a postmortem on America's inability to react. I'm going to touch on what's actually one of the smallest aspects of either version of the stimulus bill, and that's defense and national security. First, let me talk about what's in the bill. There's roughly $8 billion of military construction and environmental remediation that's clearly laid out there. And these are projects, in some cases, they're all ready to execute. In some cases, they were scheduled anyway. In others, they've been accelerated. I think in some cases, they would never have been done, but this is a great opportunity. So they'll be on the table. But I think what's far more important than those projects is what's not in the bill. Because the Defense Department actually has, as you all know, hundreds of contracts already in place for buying systems, weapons platforms, equipment, spare parts, IT services, and so on. And many of these contracts are already scheduled to spend money over years to come. And most of them could have easily been accelerated under the stimulus to a much higher capacity. The typical management tool in DOD is, in fact, to stretch out programs, which only drives up costs and delays delivery of needed items. But in this case, we really should have been doing the opposite. The stimulus effect would have been as powerful as anything else in this bill, with very high multiplier effects. And yet virtually no one in the Pentagon, in the White House, or the Congress took a look at this. Other than a half-hearted amendment by Senator Inhofe that failed on a budget point of order, there was no serious attempt at all. The question is, why? Well, here's two reasons. One is that DOD in the Bush administration largely abandoned its disciplined long-range planning and programming process. The flood of supplemental funding, the absence of any filter for probity, and the idiotic collapsing of the program review into the budget cycle combined to make it very hard for anybody in the Office of the Secretary of Defense or in the White House to have made any quick decisions on options regarding stimulus, or even to know what those options were, much less make a decision on it. The databases have actually become opaque. They can't use them. The second reason is the Congress, where, again, the spending of the past few years on national security has left many members and staff, and I heard this over and over again over the past 2 months, with the flawed notion that defense already got its share, and it's time now for somebody else. This mentality both flies in the face of the facts, and it actually continues to leave the Democrats vulnerable to charges of being anti-defense, which is a hole they've been trying to dig out of for some time. members of Congress have been quoted about we could cut defense by a third or even more. And I think that that kind of situation requires us to look at the reality. You know, for the first time in a good while, the deficit's actually bigger than the defense budget. And this removes the illusion that you can fix the deficit problem simply by cutting defense, because we could go to zero and we'd still have a deficit of historic proportions. More importantly, though, we actually face as a nation now the most significant defense challenges that we've had in at least 20 years. The Obama administration, once it finishes assembling its top team, and hopefully with the executive calendar for today, that will the final confirmation will occur today, faces essentially needs to lay out the strategy that it needs to meet the threats that it faces today. And that new team actually has to not use the imprecise rhetoric of the previous administration. They've got to really tackle it head on. But at the same time, they need to be careful not to be making decisions on killing programs until, in fact, they have that strategy in place and that threat assessment in hand. So what does that mean? We know at some point the economy is going to recover. Either that or we've got Herbert Hoover on our hands, although I'm not sure the Republicans have a Franklin Roosevelt ready to run anyway. It will recover, and then we're going to turn our attention to regaining control over the deficits. Defense will clearly be a big part of the actions needed to do that. There are so many programs today we know we're going to need more of, from unmanned aerial systems to trucks, everything in between. Under any future threat or any future strategy, we know we're going to need them. We should be buying these now, starting next week, in this stimulus package. It's obviously too late for that. But it's not too late to get ready. The next window is actually the debate over the second half of the FY09 supplemental. DOD and the White House should begin now to develop and propose the national security stimulus as part of that window. If they don't or won't do that, then the Congress should do it for them. My advice is don't miss this chance, Mr. President. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. We're now playing a political game. We've moved on from a discussion of substance. President, how many of you watched the president last night in his, well, good. You know what I'm talking about then. He emphasized time and time again the saving and creation of 4 million jobs. As you listen to our comments this morning, can you relate all these proposals contained in the bills to this desired 4 million jobs? Is there an automatic linkage, a linkage that translates directly into what America needs, and that is jobs? He also spoke about reducing our dependence on foreign oil. Last year, we cut oil consumption by about 1 million barrels a day, reflecting the impact of the financial crisis and high gasoline prices. What the stimulus package provides will be useful, but is only a step towards energy independence. Congress has been admonished to move quickly to get the bill passed and the dollars flowing. We cannot wait, we are told. But where is the oversight? Where are the guarantees that all the funds will be spent in a timely and appropriate manner? For energy, the Senate bill sets aside about $40 billion, while the House bill allocates $28.4 billion. Both bills provide for the development of clean, efficient American energy. The bills also provide for modernizing energy transmission and for development of renewable technologies, among other things. A sizable chunk of the money is to be spent on new loan guarantees for standard renewable projects such as wind or solar and for electricity projects. How about ethanol? The producers of ethanol today are in great difficulty. The price of gasoline is too low, the price of corn is too high, and many have been shut down, declared bankruptcy. So these are the people that need the loans. Much emphasis is placed on electric power transmission systems, including smart grid-related activities. How long do you think it takes to build long-distance, high-voltage transmission power lines from where the electricity is produced to where it is needed? After you've got all the permission, land permissions in place, how long do you think it takes to build a system like that? Well, we can highlight wind and solar projects. I didn't find any mention of nuclear power. The bills are far from perfect, but then there is rarely anything in Washington that can be labeled perfect. The time is usually the limiting factor. Thank you.
I promised Sidney Weintraub that I'd speak for 3 minutes so we could have plenty of time for his comments. So I'm going to just make a couple of points, and Sidney's timing me. So with respect to Asia and particularly and the impact of the stimulus and then more broadly what's going on here, and particularly Japan and China, are sort of frantically awaiting U.S. leadership on the issue and waiting for the stimulus package. If you follow Asian markets, you see that just the speculation about where the Senate would go has sent the markets into a bit of a frenzy. So they're waiting out there, both on the U.S. stimulus to right our own ship and begin to stabilize global markets, but also waiting U.S. leadership on the question of protectionism. There's a huge concern throughout Asia about the Buy America provisions, not necessarily because of the substance therein. Steve is right that by and large there are a few countries that are excluded from participation because of the Buy America provisions, but because of the signal that it sends. There's almost a geometric impact of U.S. signals to the marketplace when we seem like we're being protectionist. If we have trouble refraining from activities which seem protectionist, it seems like every other government on the planet has geometrically less ability to refrain. Last night, President Obama talked a lot about the Japan experience and the stimulus and how Timothy Geithner learned that the Japan experience was that if you don't go hard and fast on a stimulus, you're really missing the boat. And the key thing is to be decisive and to spend huge amounts early on. The bridge to nowhere was a big concern during the campaign. If you want to see some bridges to nowhere, just go to Japan. Mitch McConnell and the Republicans don't have a lot of credibility when it comes to deficit spending, but I have to say that there is significant wastefulness in this bill, and the Japan experience is as much a cautionary tale as it is something to emulate. Japan still has the highest deficit per capita out there. In China, they're looking at the U.S. stimulus again as a way to stabilize global markets. They've also got their own stimulus package, and it's interesting to see the difference between the two stimuluses. China's, of course, is designed to kickstart domestic consumption, stimulate demand, and grow the economy there. So they've done a lot to spend money in healthcare and other areas that are designed to sort of make people feel more comfortable spending money. Our issue here is, yes, we're also trying to stimulate domestic demand, but we didn't come from as low a base of demand as China did. So there's trying to stimulate U.S. demand, there was a question asked last night, isn't this really sort of getting us into the problem that we started with? And there's something to that. So that's a real concern. The big problem that I think is out there with respect to Asia, and particularly exporting Asia, is the huge emphasis and enthusiasm for the U.S. stimulus as a way to get restore the United States to the status quo ante of the crisis is that exporting Asia was hugely over-reliant on the U.S. market for its own growth to begin with. I find it very difficult to believe, even under the best of circumstances, or the worst, depending on how you grade this, that we are going to return to a status quo ante in which the United States consumer is a primary driver of global growth. So for all of the desire that the United States stimulus restore faith in the marketplace and restore the ability of other countries to grow, I don't think that the opportunities are as great for other countries through the U.S. stimulus long-term as some might believe. That has tremendous implications for U.S. power and prestige in Asia long-term, and something that we should be looking at least through our peripheral vision. But it's something we can talk about in Q&A if we get to it, because, Sydney, I think I just about did it.
Thank you, Steve. My program focuses on the long-term fiscal, economic, social, geopolitical implications of population aging. So my perspective on a near-term stimulus package is probably somewhat different than that of my colleagues. In terms of a long-term impact, I think the most significant measures are probably the health care provisions, the increased benefits and subsidies. Of course, there is the new subsidy for COBRA, as well as an extension of eligibility for COBRA for workers aged 55 and over. There is, for the first time, the opening up of Medicaid to certain unemployed workers. And then the biggest cost item, at least near term, are the direct federal subsidies to Medicaid that increase the federal matching rate for the program. Now, all of this can be justified as stimulus, or at least as a near-term emergency response to hardship, to economic hardship. And all of this is at least ostensibly temporary. But, of course, there's something called the iron rule of entitlements, which is that it's a lot easier to create a federal benefit than it is to cut back on it afterwards. And, of course, from a certain perspective, that is part of the strategy, at least among certain proponents of these benefit expansions. They're a down payment on comprehensive health care reform. Now, there's both a real opportunity and a significant danger here. The problem with comprehensive health care reform is that it has a big upfront cost. You have to bring the uninsured into the system, step one, get everybody under the tent before you can eventually start ratcheting down and controlling costs. And the upfront cost of comprehensive health care reform has been prohibitive and has made it politically dead on arrival. But that's somehow an extra $100 billion to do that seems less relevant in the midst of the current crisis. The danger, of course, is that the long-term cost control will never take place. When you talk to the public about comprehensive health care reform, what they understand is expanding access and increasing benefits and quality, not controlling costs. Now, the stimulus package actually includes some significant healthcare investments in IT technology, and at least the kernel of an approach to outcomes research that may generate some real efficiency gains. But in the long term, no amount of efficiency gains in healthcare is going to be able to put a cap on spending and keep it growing faster than the economy. So inevitably, you're going to be looking at some form of rationing. And the public is utterly unprepared for this. Nobody is advertising this. So the danger is that you're simply adding fuel to the fire. Now, just very briefly, this brings me to the second point that I wanted to make. which is the impact of the stimulus plan, and more broadly, of the economic crisis and the attempts to deal with it, both the bailouts and the stimulus plan, on the long-term deficit and debt. You may recall that back in the 1990s, when we were running budget surpluses, many hoped that we would set those aside and that would become a means of at least partially pre-funding the baby boom's retirement. Well, alas, that didn't happen. We now face the approaching demographic and fiscal gauntlet of our aging population with a budget that's already deep in deficit and is about to sink much deeper. President Obama, to his credit, has made clear that once the economy is stabilized, we need to deal seriously with the medium and long-term fiscal challenge. But I would argue that really isn't enough, that we need to deal in terms of putting on the table a credible concrete plan to address the long-term challenge in conjunction with addressing the near-term challenge, or we risk undercutting the potential impact of the near-term emergency measures that we're undertaking. The economic mess we're in is largely due to a crisis of confidence, and restoring confidence in an environment where investors worldwide are fleeing towards quality requires putting the budget on a long-term fiscally sustainable path. The United States, given the enormous investment opportunities here, our status as a reserve currency, and so forth, we tend to have the impression that we're not subject to the ordinary rules of economics, but we can't borrow hand over fist indefinitely without eventually being subject to a very high risk premium on the part of global markets. So let me just end on the thought that we need to link up the long term with the near term. I would urge the President to move on that and Congress to move on that very quickly in the months following the passage of the stimulus package, and that global markets will be watching.
Thanks for coming out today. It's interesting to track this, in part because you have to track it almost every minute. So not only can you not tell the players without a scorecard, you can't tell the scorecards without a scorecard. What are we talking about? Honestly, we're talking about a stimulus-flavored spending bill. Okay, there's stimulus elements in it. It's crucial that this passes, but there's a great degree of risk, as you've heard from many of my colleagues. I think there are three goals, fundamentally. The first is to mitigate the effects of unemployment. This is absolutely crucial, and I think the President is right to focus on it. The second is to rebuild infrastructure. We have underinvested in infrastructure as a nation for decades, and it would be useful to compensate for that. The third is to create capacity for new growth, and this is actually what I tend to work on. How do you get new growth? It's by increasing your ability to innovate. The bad news is that we're, you know, not entirely on track in this bill. It will do some good things, but it also has some things that we can ask questions about. When we talk about mitigating the effects of unemployment, perhaps the most important goal, the Senate Majority Leader Reid has said that half the spending will create new jobs. And that leads to the question then, well, what's the other half going to do? Ideally, it would rebuild infrastructure and create this ability to innovate. Let's go through it and talk about that a little bit. There's a chance that next year we'll see somewhere between 1 and 4 million jobs created. That's good, okay? But bear in mind, you know, a couple things that we've got as precedents. You've heard about the Japan precedent. One that doesn't come up very much, and I'm puzzled by this, is the 2008 stimulus. Remember that? You got $600 as a tax refund. Total waste of money, right? It was a bust. So that's a good lesson there to think about. some of the elements in the bill will only have a minimal contribution to recovery. There's spending on Homeland Security and law enforcement. I love Homeland Security and law enforcement, but we shouldn't have it in this bill. There's spending on modernizing healthcare IT. Steve will talk about healthcare. You've heard some from Richard. I'm not sure if this is such a good idea. And the bottom line here is if it doesn't create new jobs, don't do it. Okay. Talk about rebuilding infrastructure. I'm only going to say two words to think about. I think that we need to spend a lot on rebuilding infrastructure. When the bridge fell down in Minnesota, it was deeply embarrassing as a nation. But the counter to that is big dig. Okay. So create capacity for new growth. This is crucial. The way that the U.S. will expand its economy is by rebuilding the ability to innovate. Again, this is an area where we have underinvested for more than a decade. It's up in the air. Some of the Senate cuts focus on cutting money for R&D. That's probably a mistake. You've got all sorts of what I would call nostrums in there. They're kind of like herbal medicine innovation techniques. Invest in broadband, open access. These aren't going to do it for you, and I'll tell you why in a minute. The issue in broadband is not really access, you know, bringing it. When I see the word, it says underserved, but I sometimes accidentally read that as undeserved, right? Bringing broadband to areas that are not in the center of our economic life will not create new jobs. It will not create new growth. This might be a good thing to do. It's a wonderful social policy, but let's not pretend it's a stimulus, and maybe we should reserve on it. Education spending. Spending on education is really important, but we have a very big problem, and that problem is our education spending is already overfunded, right? Things like construction for schools, the famous example is Milwaukee. There was money. Who knows today? Maybe it's gone. There was money for Milwaukee to build new schools. I think that's wonderful, except that Milwaukee has a declining enrollment. They already have 15 empty schools. Why are we spending that money? It won't create a new capacity to innovate. We do need to spend money on education, but it's got to be targeted the right way. One thing to think about is how do we pay for all this? Because what I've discovered in studying innovation and entrepreneurship is there's always a problem, and it's called money, right? How do I get people to invest in new things? When we think about paying for this stimulus package, there are three things the U.S. will have to do. This is inevitable, and it will be one or some blend of these. Taxes will have to go up, right? And that possibly could be dodged. The way you would dodge it is by having higher inflation. Inflation is a hidden tax, right? If we don't raise taxes, we'll have to inflate, right? If we don't raise taxes and we try and avoid inflation, we'll have to borrow. And the problem with borrowing is that the money you take to pay for these government programs now will be money that's not available for new investment or innovation or entrepreneurship in the future. This is the crucial risk for me when I look at this bill. So a couple things in conclusion. First of all, the bad news, the bubble is not coming back. I loved it. You know, I was a stock genius during the bubble. You could pick any stock and it would go up. It's not coming back. I'm sorry. More money is not the solution. We already overspend in some crucial areas. We overspend in education. We overspend in healthcare. We overspend in housing construction, right? The question is not do we need to spend more, but how do we spend better? Not clear this bill will address that. It's a goal for the administration to tackle over the next 4 or 8 years that it's in office, but it's not tackled in this bill. The problem is not a lack of money in many of these areas. It's that we lack new ways of doing things. Okay. One thing to think about when you talk about creating the capacity for growth is what the World Bank would call soft infrastructure, your regulations, your laws, your financial system. This is as important as investment, but it's not addressed at all in this bill. So we're only doing half of one side of the car in driving forward towards the ability to grow the American economy. And we should not think that this bill fixes America's innovation problem. It does some good things. It's crucial to pass it, but it doesn't fix the innovation problem. Now, here's a prediction. You can all be irritated by this. I think the recession will end in 2010, no matter what we do. Right? That's sort of the historical precedent. I'm betting on that occurring. Okay. Our goals in the interim, though, are to mitigate the suffering that will occur. There will be suffering. When we were talking about currently a 7.6 unemployment rate, but if you include the people who've given up out of despair and are not looking for work, it's closer to 14% of the population is unemployed. That's dreadful. We have to fix that now. But when we do that, we have to keep the eye on the fact that the things we do to mitigate the problems should not cripple our ability to grow in the future when we get out of this. And doing that will be very tricky. I think we're halfway there in this bill, so it depends on whether you're an optimist or not. If you're an optimist, let me tell you, the glass is half full.
Thank you. Good morning, Steve. Thank you for pulling us together. I wanted to offer some quick thoughts on the external strategy of foreign assistance with some reference to special reference to global health, but also with reference to what may lie ahead in terms of new multiple forms of instability that arise in the midst of this global recession, worsening global recession, what that might mean to us. We're coming off a period in which we've made unprecedented historical investments in global health. We're running at $7.5 billion per year, and we've dramatically expanded ODA overall. President Obama made a commitment in the campaign to doubling ODA from $25 to $50 billion. There are risks that we lose sight of the in this midst of this inward turn, this dramatic, very anxious inward turn, in the midst of great uncertainty, that we do not pay close enough attention to protecting and sustaining the existing investments and the bipartisanship which is underlay them, and that we are communicating externally what our game plan is, both bilaterally and multilaterally. We've come off of a period of relative euphoria. If you look at the PEPFAR reauthorization bill that passed both chambers and was signed into law by the President at the end of July, it was a $48 billion program, very euphoric, just scarcely 6 weeks before the collapse of Lehman Brothers. We're facing new threats. We're facing the possibility that the economic convulsions translate into ever broader forms of political and security instability in multiple different categories of states. We have weak and failing states. We've already seen in 2008 the food and fuel crisis that led to rioting in over 30 countries and a pool of roughly 40 very vulnerable countries, many of them in Africa. Those weaknesses and vulnerabilities have not lessened. They've intensified as DFI, as remittances, as markets, and as ODA have all declined in this last period. So we should expect in those states more difficulty. We should expect the global downturn to result in the transmission of new forms of instability, both politically and in terms of security. And if you look at the other states, the oil-producing states, the export-dependent states, we can expect other patterns to be emerging. We're in this period, though, where the U.S. opinion climate is quite unclear on this. I think overall there's an enormous amount of survey work underway which shows that the American public is losing and becoming more skeptical and losing its enthusiasm around foreign assistance engagement in the midst of these circumstances. And moreover, we have a certain ambiguity or uncertainty about the leadership of our major agencies here in the United States and what the strategies are. None of the major foreign aid agencies have had leaderships selected, and there's outstanding confusion both within the administration and on the Hill as to what the foreign aid strategy is going to look like looking forward. That's a vulnerability. And in the midst of the breakdown of partisanship, the breakdown of bipartisanship around the stimulus bill raises the whole question of whether it's going to be whether that trend is going to be carried over into the and create new tensions around trying to preserve existing gains and make good on commitments. We are going to see a crowd out effect. We're going to see a greater turn towards multilaterals. Robert Zoellick is calling for $1 trillion, 1% of global GDP Marshall Plan fund to offset some of these shocks that are expected. Internally, we can expect to see much greater pressure coming from an Afghan reconstruction program that will appear this year. We will see greater criticism of America's standing and image in the world if we're not very, very careful in this next period, if we're seen as basically complacent or negligent in thinking about these points. There's going to be a high value on getting greater efficiencies and demonstrating impacts on the current investments, and a much higher value on leadership by the President and others at key inflection points. The April G20 meeting in London will be critical. The G8 meeting in Italy in July. The summit in September in New York at the UN General Assembly. So I'll just close with those comments. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to thank you for pulling all of this together. I have a few comments, and I hope I can say it in 5 minutes. I plan to. You've heard a lot now about job creation, and as you listened last night to the President Obama, he made that his first point. And I think properly, that really is what this is about, because unemployment, despite the high figures that Steve just gave, unemployment's going to keep going up this year, almost despite everything else we do, and he's got to figure out a way to create jobs. And that's properly the first priority. And there are a lot of problems connected with that. Unemployment, and you've already heard, unemployment is connected with health care, the way our health care system works. It runs across the gamut. The other priority that I think is second, and I was pleased that President Obama made that second yesterday, was to get credit flowing again. We're beginning to get a little bit more credit, interbank credit, banks lending to each other, because of a lot of the assurances being given about these things being paid back. But we don't have enough credit going to the private sector. And the more you read and the more you speak to business people, you discover a lot of them are going out of business because of credit. They can't get credit. Countries around the world, middle-income countries that are important exporters, can't export, not only because the U.S. economy is declining, the European economy is declining, the Japanese economy is not growing. That drives down exports of all of these countries, but they can't get trade credits to be able to deal them through, and most trade takes place through credits. You're selling today and you get paid back 180 days later or something of that nature. And I think that really is quite critical, and I'm glad that he made that the second most important point. A third point I'd like to make, that is, if more money is necessary to keep the banks stable, and I think there will be more money needed, the United States, I think, unlike what it did in the first time, TARP funding, should, I think, actually take equity positions in the banks. This gives them an ability to run the incentives, and I'll come back to the incentives in a moment. I don't think nationalization is necessary, but I wouldn't flinch against nationalization. And I hope they don't, if that turns out to be necessary. In a way, that's happening. That happened around the world and other places. But I don't think it'll be necessary. But I think this is not necessarily in the stimulus package. It's going to come up a good deal in the proposals that Secretary of the Treasury Geithner is going to give today. I want to stress the incentives because I think the employee, what is now self-evident, is that the employee and management incentives were all wrong. The incentives were designed to derive short-term profits no matter how risky, and as they derived these short-term profits, they just took bigger bonuses. I find it hard to blame the employees. That's the way the structure was set up. I do find a good deal to criticize in the managers who knew they were taking risks. But they made so much money, they apparently didn't give a damn. And I think that's unforgivable as what they did to the rest of us in the economy and what they accomplished in the rest of the world, taking these incentives even as they were losing tremendous sums of money. I think, and you'll hear this more about this today, I think an aggregator bank, what people tend to call a bad bank, is a good idea. It'll come today in one form or another from Geithner. The model for this is Sweden. I think you've all read about it. And at the end of the period of time, after Sweden sold its bad bank, its aggregator bank, whatever you want to call it, back to the private sector, they actually made money. There are a lot of ways to run this without setting a price too quickly as to what these bad debts are worth. But I think you have to get those debts off the books of the banks if the banks are going to expand credit. The first part of the stimulus, the first part of TARP, the first $350 billion was not well spent. It was not thought through. Money was paid out without getting a lot of the commitments that were needed. I think Paulson was playing it by ear, and he kept changing, as you all saw, when he shifted from getting rid of the toxic assets to putting money into the banks. I don't think it was all wasted, but it could be it could be better this time. And I expect you'll find a much better program from Geithner, although I don't – all I know of what's in it is what I've been reading in the newspapers. My own view is that the House bill is better than the Senate bill, despite all the compromises in the Senate bill. The House bill has more aid to the states than the Senate bill, and it's beyond me why they pulled that out. The states really are bankrupt, and if they don't get money, there's so many things that they have to do that they're not going to be able to do. I don't know the logic in reducing the money. Some of the Senate tax initiatives are not going to lead to any greater spending or stimulus. For example, getting rid of the alternative minimum tax is very nice. I think we ought to get rid of it permanently someday. But it's if I pay some of the alternative minimum tax, I'm sure many of you do, and if I got that money back, I wouldn't spend it. I'd save it. And this is not intended to be that kind of stimulus. I think you need the spending, and I think that should be the main criterion. I think something is needed on housing. I don't know how to deal with housing. I think people who took loans they couldn't pay and then are finding trouble, brought the trouble on themselves. But there are a lot of people who are trying to actually make the payments and having a hard time doing it. And remember how this whole problem started. It started with the subprime loans and the idea that the banks could make all they wanted, package them in bad paper, sell that around the world, help destroy a lot of the rest of the world in the process. And I think that part of the problem has to be dealt with. I guess what I'm saying is, yes, there are long-term dangers. I don't think it's too useful to make a long-term program now, despite some of my colleagues, because we have to see how this thing starts working. If this thing works properly, and it may in part, I think it probably will in part, it will not completely, that'll help the long term. If the economy is growing faster, that raises tax revenue. And you don't necessarily need higher taxes for that. In other words, I think really we should be talking about one-year stimulus, some of the infrastructure projects that may go for 2 years or so, some of the health care things, which may take a couple of years. If anything goes beyond that, connected to this program, it's not a stimulus spending program. Thank you.
With that, we'd like to open it up to questions from the audience, right in the center.
Yes, for Weintraub.
Thank you. What role do you think there is for looking at accounting measures like mark-to-market and regulatory issues like increased bank capital to help on the credit markets?
Yeah, it's something we all left out, and it's an important point. I think there's a lot of room for looking at those kinds of things. I wouldn't write off mark-to-market automatically. After all, the taxes, for the moment, and maybe for the next 3, 4, 5, 6 years, the toxic assets are not going to be worth very much. Nobody will buy them, and therefore to count them as assets on the book doesn't strike me as a very, very prudent way to do it. It's why I want to get them off their books. So if they have mark-to-market, they don't count very much that way. But to change the measurement leaves me a little cold. The idea of regulation, though, we need a lot of regulation. We do know that we weren't regulating enough. Now, they're all blaming us. They're all blaming the banks. That's fine. But you have to remember that the Senate voted almost unanimously, the Congress voted almost unanimously to get rid of all the regulations that got us into trouble. I mean, it's pretty good for them to blame everybody else. But they started the process. That's a very important part of the program.
Front row. There appears to me sort of a cynical consensus that this incentive package, because of its speed and the sense of urgency, that it's entirely subject to waste, fraud, and abuse. That there is no way to move a package large and swiftly into the public and be able to avoid waste, fraud, and abuse. How is that necessarily so? Have we learned nothing? I mean, we've all read from the 30s, we've read from the 80s, we've read from the 90s, and 2008 had lessons in it as well. How about some suggestions about how to avoid waste, fraud, and abuse while moving a large amount of money into the economy quickly?
I think that's an important point. I mean, some of it, I think, is limited in terms of the mechanisms that are used in the bill. And I think there's always a tension between time, cost, and quality, just in terms of how things move forward. Not necessarily in the fact that that's intentional, but you've got to move things, projects that are shovel-ready, as the term of art is used, or otherwise ready to go versus doing long-term planning. One piece that was in the bill was this an oversight board that was supposed to be headed by the performance czar that, you know, subsequently had to withdraw their nomination. There's a good scope need for research and looking at whether you need some type of operation in the White House or otherwise it could strategically target how the money's used or as it's being rolled out. And I think that's a very key question. I don't know whether because the bill was designed to move so quickly, it didn't allow for that kind of operation to be set up or running. But I think at least the performance group that was envisioned by the bill was a step towards that direction. I don't know, Sidney or others, if you have other comments on this piece.
I don't join the consensus you said there was, that there must be waste, fraud, and abuse. I think there will be, I don't think it necessarily has to be in this bill. What I was criticizing was not waste, fraud, and abuse. That's a cliche any time anybody wants to criticize the government. What I was really concerned about is the politics that were put into a good many of the proposals, and they were deliberately put in there. And the people who were pushing this stimulus bill, like President Obama, knows that politics was put into this bill, more politics in the Senate than in the House. But if you wanted to get a measure passed, what did you expect them to do?
I don't think of it as waste, fraud, and abuse as well. No, I know. And actually, waste, fraud, and abuse doesn't bother me. I mean, a little. Any program's going to have a little bit. Just accept it. You know, sorry. If you're a regulator or law enforcement person, that's good because you'll always be busy. But the issue is if we have a set of goals. You know, we want to do a test. We need to mitigate unemployment now. We need to restore credit, as Sidney said. We need to think a little bit about long-term investments that have been shortchanged for the last decade. If there's a part of the bill that doesn't contribute to one of those three things, maybe we should take a step back. So I think your second term, inefficiency, is the part that more of us share, is that
you know, spending is good, we need to do it, but let's think about, is everything in that bill something we need to spend on just this minute?
There is one thing that's important to add to that. Oversight is often thought of as after the fact. That's typically what we talk about. It's a heck of a lot better if, in fact, it's paid attention to up front. One of the problems is that the federal government across the board has substantially less capacity today to do the job right up front, whether it's grant awards, whether it's contract writing, whether it's doing competitions, whether it's writing a sole source justification where there is no competition. Nothing in this bill addresses that issue. And, you know, putting more auditors at the back end is not going to do a whole lot to writing the contract better up front. That's something that really ought to be done. Senator Coburn introduced an amendment. This may be the first amendment he's ever had that passed 97-0 on a voice vote that required every grant, cooperative agreement, or contract awarded under this bill to be competitively bid. That, if you read his language carefully, it was, of course, particularly badly written. But it also permits two things. Number one, it fails to recognize a lot of this money will actually be spent by the states. And states have their own laws. And what is waste to one state is, in fact, compliance with the law in another. For example, set-asides for small disadvantaged veteran-owned businesses of 3% that have to be from my state. Well, that sort of is a competitive limitation if you don't happen to have such a business on your team and will allow you to win contracts non-competitively. But, in fact, it's been deemed important to the state that disadvantaged, disabled, veteran-owned businesses should have a way to play here. So one guy's waste is, in fact, another guy's compliance with a socially demanding good thing. So I think it's important to keep all of that in mind as we go through this.
Question over here. By and large, answered. I was going to say, you know, if the Air Force, with all the checks and balances that DOD has, if the Air Force had a hard time with a large procurement,
what's going to happen with such a quick amount of money being spent? So I think it's been addressed. Thank you.
And I think, as David just building on that point, a lot of this money is going out to the states very rapidly, and the question is absorption capacity and whether they have the kind of robust structures to deal with this big inflow too in this short time is going to be another key question. But I think we had a question right there as well.
The question was, I listened to the president last night. I listened to him very carefully, and I heard him say, we can disagree on the mix of elements between tax and spending. But he said, those who say we should do nothing, that's simply not an option. Who are these folks, and what is their rationale for saying we should do nothing? I'm unclear about that. Certainly, stimulus means spending, if I understand the English language.
There are plenty of Austrians still among us that believe in the power of markets and believe that deflation is not something to fight against so dramatically. For most of our country's history, when we went through periods like this, we allowed deflation to take shape and to actually allow wages to decrease so there wasn't such unemployment. Herbert Hoover was the first president that introduced the notion that we don't want to allow this kind of deflationary practice to take hold, to effectively do nothing. I think we're beyond the point where where doing nothing is politically viable, but economically, it's viable. So,
take a look at Georgia on Election Day. Steve Chambliss initially voted against the TARP. When it came back in the Senate, he voted for it. He damn near lost the election in a state that's 64% Republican because of his vote on TARP. You know, it's important to keep in mind that all 535 of these people, well, there's not quite that many now because there's a few vacancies yet to be determined, but you know, the number one rule is survive. You know, not the nation, but my seat and me in it. And that what happened to Steve Chambliss echoed throughout the Republican Party, and that is a very powerful driver, and I think it's important to remember that.
President last night, and I've heard all the reporters.
Bill, sir, if you use the microphone, we'll all.
I said I've heard you eight gentlemen. I heard the president last night, and I heard the reporters, 13 reporters, no one has asked the simple question, if there's 1.5 million people unemployed, what type of jobs do they need to get reemployed? And then you say, well, I'm going to shift them to building highways, building schools. They may not be the people that have the ability to do that. And I just think that that has to be in the equation. Secondly, I think the scholars should take a look at the fact that part of our problem is that we've sent a lot of money outside of the United States to people that haven't put it back in the system the way other people put it back. You know, for example, the amount of money we sent to the Saudis for their oil, they never put that money back in the system in the way which would create new jobs. And for that reason, I'm willing to give people relief, but I don't think you should spend your money, and I think that some of you should go back to reading Keynes and the other who try to talk about the multiplier and how you create jobs in a capitalist society.
Sidney, did you want to take the first part of that?
There may be some retraining that's going to be needed. In the construction area, I think it's a lot less than you imply if we're talking about construction, things like roads, bridges, schools. There's a good deal of that, and I think the retraining that's needed is not extensive. After all, during the New Deal, that's one of the things they did. They did extensively. Retraining may be necessary for a lot of other things. A lot of people are going to have to change what they do. Now, they'll need retraining. So education becomes very important. Yes, there are, on questions of sending money out of the country that never comes back into the system, it's not completely absent from the system because it goes into banks in the most part, and that brings it somewhat back into the system. But yet, a lot of money goes overseas. It's not brought back in the most productive way. But the idea that we shouldn't let money go overseas, I don't know how you can do that at the same time not have a protectionist policy. The idea, the question of what's being proposed on trade is really not that it's illegal. It's legal if we don't have a commitment. And as somebody said earlier, there's no commitment to countries like China and India and Brazil that are not part of the procurement arrangements in the World Trade Organization. So it's not just legality. It's just the idea that intimating that the United States is prepared to be protectionist at the margin at a time like this is what troubles a lot of people. It troubles me deeply, particularly since what they're proposing, as one study at the Peterson Institute brings out, creates practically no new jobs. Anyhow, yes, what you say is accurate, but it's not quite as bad, I think, as you put it.
I have a bit of an answer to Bob's question about who are those people that say don't do anything. You mean the government, right? Okay. Well, there's a think tank here in town which says get the government out of everything. And they're the people who say don't do anything. Cato Institute. Okay.
We have time for one more question, maybe far in the back.
Thank you. I'd like to congratulate Steve on putting this together. You guys really exceeded my expectations on what type of information and quality information, especially given what I've been reading in the paper. And I don't think I've ever read any more nonsense about any issue that I've read in the papers over the last 2 years on this crisis. So first I'd like to make some comments, and then I'd like to elaborate on what this gentleman said, because I think this gentleman made a very good point that everybody's missing, including our appointed officials. So, Sidney, first of all, comment on where you're looking at who the problem is. I think you miss one crucial person, which I think you think about it, you'll agree, and that's the board. I think the board of directors of a lot of the corporations, a lot of financial institutions, have just not done their fiduciary responsibility. I think we've ignored that. I think the TARP bailing these people out without taking them into bankruptcy was really a bad policy. Because you need to get rid of the boards, you need to get rid of the management. You not only need to get rid of the bad assets, you got to get rid of the bad actors. Okay, some very good points were made up here on the selection of the program and defense. And I think one of the things we haven't looked at in dealing with this is first, the shocks to the economy, which have been primarily international, affect the long-run growth rate of the economy. The long-run growth rate of the economy without a massive restructuring has probably dropped 2 percentage points since the end of the year. I don't hear anybody addressing that, and I don't hear anybody refuting my analysis. They say, oh, that's just not important. I think it's very important. It's very important for tax revenues. It's very important for the problems that we're going to be able to address in the future, okay? And that's due in part to immigration. Immigration and the immigration bill of 2007 took a problem that was we got through in the 90s, we've gotten through other times, and made it a disaster, okay? If anybody wants to hear more about that, I'm more than happy to say more about that. But I want to get back to the issue that this gentleman raised, because I think it's another issue that we just have not thought through. And Sidney talked, you know, really about the one side, which is the trade side. But Sidney and I both, you know, I think, will agree on this. There's the three principles of international macroeconomics, international macro monetary policy. There are three items. You only have two. Okay, capital mobility, fixed or flexible exchange rates, and independent monetary policy. Okay? This gentleman was talking about money going and parking. Okay, that's because they don't have independent monetary policy, right? They fix their exchange rates, so their international reserves go up. So what happened in the first half of 2008? Okay, the international reserves exploded in China, exploded in the OPEC countries, and what did we get? A doubling of prices in that are traded on international exchanges. It wasn't just an oil problem. It was everybody. Okay, and that's not too hard to explain. So there is this issue. Then the issue is, why has U.S. monetary policy been so ineffective? It's because the folks who are on fixed exchange rates have gotten so large that we no longer have independent monetary policy. In other words, we got monetary policies formed in the central banks of both the U.S., China, and Japan, which essentially was on fixed exchange rates till recently. But I would certainly like to compliment the people on this panel. You've really addressed, you know, a lot of the crucial items in a certainly a lot more informative way than we've been reading in the press.
That, I think, a lot of critical points, and I'd like to thank you all for coming here. These are issues we're going to keep following in the months ahead, and thank you for all of your interest.